Blog Talk Radio.
Joanna Macy, A Wiser, Braver World.
This transition to a life-sustaining culture is a revolution in the magnitude and scope comparable to the agricultural revolutions in 1,000 years ago. But we've taken, in the work that we connect to, calling it the Great Turning.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Chief Antonio Guterres on Tuesday added his voice to growing international calls for a war crimes investigation into the killing of civilians in the Ukrainian town of Bucha. The Secretary General's comments came after shocking images from Bucha on the outskirts of Kyiv showed hundreds of dead people, some with bullet wounds and their hands tied behind their backs, and others burned or in mass graves in areas previously under the control of Russian troops. Mr. Guterres told the UN Security Council that an independent probe was needed to guarantee effective accountability. In Geneva, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, explained that the episode marked a new low in the war, with victims' bodies desecrated in death. OHCHR spokesperson Liz Throssell said that all the signs were that the victims were directly targeted and killed.
It's hard to see what was the military context of an individual lying in the street with a bullet to the head or having their body burned.
To Sri Lanka, where the UN Rights Office on Tuesday urged authorities to defuse tensions peacefully after a state of emergency was declared in response to protests over the country's deep economic crisis. In the capital, Colombo, and beyond, people's concerns have been rising in recent months amid soaring costs for basic goods linked to a lack of foreign currency caused by COVID restrictions. The UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said that the situation had worsened and that there have been shortages of food and fuel along with power cuts, prompting new protests by desperate Sri Lankans. Citing reports of excessive and unwarranted police violence against protesters, the UN Rights Office also said that social media networks had been shut down for 15 hours. Any use of emergency measures by the state must comply with international human rights law, said OHCHR, its statement coming after UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet in February pointed to Sri Lanka's worrying drift towards militarization. Desperately needed food aid has reached Ethiopia's Tigray region, where hundreds of thousands of people are close to famine, UN humanitarians have confirmed. The development comes after a ceasefire was agreed in late March between federal authorities in Addis Ababa and forces loyal to Tigrayan separatists. The truce, which follows nearly 17 months of brutal conflict in northern Ethiopia, mean that fuel tankers have been able to reach regional capital Mekelle, the World Food Programme, or WFP, said. In a tweet at the weekend, WFP said that more than 47,000 litres of fuel were busy refueling aid vehicles so that relief can reach the most vulnerable communities. The UN agency noted, however, that 200,000 litres of fuel are needed every week to meet humanitarian needs in the region. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alice Smith.
As we are going, mega drought will be so common in some places that will be the new normal. In fact, scientists say we may already be there. Other parts of the world are changing toward extreme rains and floods over and over again. Worst of all, in a superheated future, extreme events like wildfires and floods can follow one another in quick succession, like a 1-2 punch. This is the new world we make by burning fossil fuels. We can find it all in new science from University of California assistant professor and researcher Dr. Samantha Stevenson. She works with a small team of expert co-authors. Samantha Stevenson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, great. Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
You know, even before we get to this drastic new future, some other rude news has intruded. You were also a project scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. NCAR, as it's known, works to establish climate impacts, including fires. Recently, staff at NCAR were evacuated due to a nearby wildfire. It was called the NCAR fire. Is that ironic?
I suppose, but unfortunately, it's something that is more and more to be expected. I watched the news very closely CN Car Fire. A lot of friends of mine live in that neighborhood, and we've been seeing wildfire in Boulder more and more frequently over the past years as well.
Let's go to a new paper you led, published March 14, 2022, in the prestigious journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The title is 21st Century Hydroclimate, a Continually Changing Baseline with More Frequent Extremes. What was the purpose of this study, Samantha?
Oh, sure. I guess the purpose of the title of the study is suggested by the title, right? So we've known for a while that under climate change, under future projected warming, we expect significant trends in what we call hydroclimate, so like dryness and wetness, or the amount of moisture available in the soil. So what we wanted to know is, how do you incorporate our understanding of those trends when you're thinking about what constitutes a drought event? There's also been some previous work that suggests that, you know, these mega droughts, like sustained droughts that last for multiple decades, the risk of those will become almost 100% in the future. And what I wanted to say is that that is actually a consequence of just the background trend towards increasing dryness. And so one question that we wanted to answer is, has mega drought become normal? And if so, when? The result of that calculation was that mega drought has in fact already become normal in places like the Western U.S., Western Europe, Australia, and Southern Africa. And in other places, extreme wet conditions are becoming normal in places like India and Eastern Africa. So that was one question that we were trying to answer. And then the other thing that we wanted to do was to say, okay, what is a drought? Like, when the background state is changing underneath you, what does it even mean to be in a drought, which is usually something that we define as drier than normal, right? If normal is becoming drier, when do you then experience a drought? And so what we did with the climate models is said, okay, we have some idea of how fast normal is changing. Let's kind of correct for that and then see if we can do that, if the change between our new continuously changing normal and a drought event is actually any different. And we find that, in fact, it isn't. So basically, droughts themselves aren't changing that much, but normal is, right? So these trends are huge, and so that means that we're going to have to continuously adapt to a state of normal that is becoming drier every year, at least in the Western U.S.
Listeners in the West understand the term megadrought too well, but I want to get to some of your new projections about megapluvials, and I don't think that's a term most people know. What is that?
You know, it's basically the opposite of a mega drought, right? So a mega drought would be typically a period where it stays drier than normal for multiple decades. Right? And so a megapluvial is just the opposite, right? So instead of being drier than normal, you would be wetter than normal for, in this case, like 15 years or so.
Well, last October, northern China was struck by extreme rains for days on end. According to communist newspaper Shaanxi Evening News, 190,000 hectares or 470,000 acres of cropland was flooded and wrecked. It's another blow to global wheat stocks. Chinese scientists do blame climate change, and they wonder if it's the new normal there. Is that a pluvial event, or is it something that has to take over a longer period to qualify in your study?
Well, that's an interesting question. So our study actually looked at a couple of different timescales. So this mega drought, mega pluvial thing I've been talking about, that's more of like a slow variation, or a low frequency. So just like on average, the amount of moisture that's changing over a long period of time. That's this mega drought, mega pluvial. And I think what you're talking about in the Chinese context, or what we is more of like a seasonal thing, like it's like it was a really wet year, or there was a series of extreme rainstorms. And so we thought about that in our study as well. And it looks like if you think about just, you know, having a really wet winter, for example, as we said, like are there 90-day periods where it's just super wet? And in fact, yes, there certainly are. That's just expected without climate change to begin with. But now that climate change is happening, those wet years are expected to become even wetter as well. So even in places where you're seeing this trend towards drier and drier and drier conditions in general, you can have particular wet years that become even wetter and kind of punctuating that increased dryness.
I think the question you worked on is a little bit difficult to comprehend at first, but it's important, and that is, will the extremes be even more extreme, or will they not really seem that way because the normal is extreme? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, kind of. Right? Humans were able to adapt to a lot of different things, right? And our idea of what is normal in a lot of different contexts can change from year to year. We see that with, like, technology improvements, with, you know, some different political types of changes, right? And so we wanted to say, like, is that true for hydroclimate as well, right? And so, yeah, so if your idea of normal is just continuously changing, then what you're actually kind of sensing as if you're trying to, say, manage water or something like that, you're dealing not with what was normal 50 years ago, but what is normal now, right? And so that's kind of the hopeful message of our study is saying, yeah, like, once we can get our heads around this idea that, like, we have to adjust to normal changing underneath us, the variability, like, those high frequency, those individual years and things like that, like, those are something that maybe we could manage for more effectively. And that's not going to change as much.
Your team finds that almost two-thirds of Earth's habitable land surface will experience either drought or extreme wetting. Could those extremes last for decades, or would they be permanent in human timescales? What do you think?
So it looks like that 60% of the land surface where that signal we call emerges from the noise, that is going to essentially mean that either mega drought or mega pluvial or extreme wet conditions, those just, like, we know we don't come back below that threshold. So that's why we're essentially in a permanent mega drought in the western U.S.
Wow. Well, Samantha Stevenson, you began your scientific studies as an astronomer. Astronomers need to be time travelers in a way because they're mapping light from distant stars that was emitted a long, long time ago. Do you think that perspective helps you construct a future for this planet now that you're in climate research?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think so. I mean, I think it's helpful to have a long-term perspective in general. Right. So, yeah, as an astronomer, you tend to think more in, you know, the millions of years or billions of years kind of time scale. Right. So what is the fate of the universe kind of thing? And from that perspective, like, you know, climate change is certainly bad. It is certainly having a lot of negative consequences everywhere in the world. But I tend to look at it as, like, we, you know, we will adapt. Right. The Earth will be okay. It's just, what is society going to look like when we get to whatever state we eventually stabilize at, right? And so we're not there yet. We're in a time of transition. But my hope is that by understanding, like, how this climate variability and these types of impacts respond to long-term changes in climate, then we can be more prepared and we can, you know, be ready for the Earth that we will have once we eventually stabilize our CO2 emissions.
Well, this PNAS paper finds megadrought already developing in the southern United States and northern Mexico, in the Amazon, the majority of Europe, and southern Africa. But long-lasting drought may appear in other surprising places in coming decades, like northern Canada. I never would have guessed that one.
Yeah, that's true. That's the one that I was not expecting either. And so that'll be interesting to watch. I mean, that seems to be, like, some of these places are places where we had a lot of snowpack persisting throughout the year. And so maybe part of that is that we're just seeing some melting of that. But we haven't looked at the high latitudes in as much detail yet. But yeah, it'll be interesting to try to think about those as well.
Did you find the appearance of some mega pluvial events might be delayed until later in this century? And if so, why?
Yeah, so the mega pluvial emergence does seem to be somewhat later than the emergence of the mega drought. So, like, it takes longer for wetter conditions to become normal, essentially. I'm guessing that has to do with the drivers of those trends, right? So in a lot of places where it's drying out, that the reason why it's drying is because of temperature, right? So we're very sure that the land surface is warming rapidly, it's warming consistently over a lot of places, and all the climate models agree on that. And with rain, it's a little more complicated. There's a lot more variability in rainfall. Like, the different climate models tend to agree less well on the exact details of it. And so that means that, like, statistically, it might take us longer to be sure that we can detect a change that's outside of what we would consider normal now. And so I would think that that would be why that kind of that emergence time, or like the year in which we can be sure we're no longer coming back to normal.
On our current greenhouse path with the high emissions, and you do assume that in the paper, the new normal for almost a third of settled Earth is really a new extreme pattern. In fact, your paper says, quote, the entire 21st century is identified as a single large event. Could you explain what that means?
I'm calling it a single large event because it would be if you defined your event as any time where you're below an absolute threshold. In the past, we have defined a megadrought as any period where the soil moisture is below a certain level, right? And that certain level is defined based on what normal was over the past, say, 30 years, okay? And the trouble is that we are in this situation where climate change is happening. We have a continuous trend towards drier and drier and drier conditions in the Western U.S., right? And so if you have a static threshold, if you're saying it has to be below, I don't know, minus one, let's say, just to make up a number, right? But you're subtracting one from that amount of moisture every year. But yeah, you're always going to be below minus one because you keep subtracting from it, right? And so that's why we wanted to say that's not at a certain point very useful anymore, because we know that we're always going to be in a drought because we decided what a drought was 50 years ago, right? And so that's what we were trying to do with this paper, is to say, okay, well, like, what is a more useful definition of drought? A more useful one would take into account the fact that we are continuously changing the amount of moisture that's available in the soil. And what we care about is just the deficit relative to what we expect it would be normal for right now.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest scientist Samantha Stevenson from the University of California, Santa Barbara. We're talking about extreme weather events as the new normal. We could talk about Australia, Southern Europe, and many places, but let's move to a classic case of extremes with your latest paper, released April 1st, Climate Change Increases Risk of Extreme Rainfall Following Wildfire in the Western United States. That paper is led by Danielle Tuma at NCAR, and you are co-author. What was your goal with this paper?
Yeah, so our goal for this paper was to understand not only the risk due to one type of extreme, but the risk due to multiple things happening at once. So, Danielle was in my lab at UC Santa Barbara when we started this work, and we got really interested in this because in Southern California and in Colorado, where she now is based, you see both wildfires and extreme rainfall. And if both of those, if you have a fire and then a rainstorm immediately afterwards, when the vegetation hasn't had a chance to regrow or anything like that, then you can have really severe impacts. In Montecito, California, just down the road from us in Santa Barbara, actually this happened in 2018, and many people died. It was one of the most destructive fires in Southern California history at the time. And so we wanted to say, okay, well, we have these great modeling tools, and we know that both the climate change is going to increase both the risk associated with wildfires and the frequency of extreme rainfall. So you would think that the risk of both of those happening in rapid sequence would also increase. And we can actually quantify that using these large sets of model simulations that we have. And so we said, well, let's do that. And in fact, the risk of those, what we call compound extremes, does get magnified kind of by an enormous amount in some parts of the Western U.S.
In 2021, my home province of British Columbia in Canada shared the intense heat dome and multiple giant wildfires that were found in the Pacific Northwest, Washington State, and Oregon. Then just 2 months after that provincial fire emergency was lifted in September, we were hit with unbelievable amounts of rain. All highways, rail connections to the rest of Canada were cut off by landslides and floods. Is that an example of the kind of events that you studied in this paper?
Yeah, I suppose it would be. So we were looking at compound extremes, but for the particular index that we were using is a little bit different from the heat dome. It's the only reason that I hesitate, right? So we were looking at to represent the weather conditions that would be associated with wildfire using this thing called the Fire Weather Index that takes into account both temperature, humidity, and winds, and things like that. So, yeah, I would think that the heat dome events would have had a pretty large Fire Weather Index value. I just don't know what that was specifically for that event. But yeah, like there's these types of swings between super hot and dry conditions and, as you said, unbelievable amounts of rain is exactly the type of thing that we were interested in. And it does look like it will become quite a bit more frequent in the future.
Well, it's weird because extreme rains tend to do worse damage after a fire when the fire might be up in the mountains. Cities downstream can be flooded out and debris can collect in the rivers and damage fisheries, all sorts of things. It's strange that the post-flood zone is bigger than the post-fire zone in some cases.
Yeah, and that's kind of one example where the net effect of two extremes happening in rapid sequence can be a lot more destructive than what would happen if each of them had happened individually. And part of the reason why it's important to try to use like these large global data sets to try to say, like, what is the actual spatial pattern of both the impact of both the events individually and their sequence.
You know, we never heard the term atmospheric river in TV weather talk until a few years ago. Are there more of them, and what can we expect in coming decades? Is that part of this flood after fire picture?
It is. Yeah, we didn't look at atmospheric rivers specifically in any of our papers, although I would imagine that the extreme rainfall events that we see are often associated with atmospheric rivers. We just weren't looking for like those circulation patterns specifically, but yeah, like in California and yeah, in the Pacific Northwest as well, a lot of the most extreme rainfall events have to do with the landfall of atmospheric rivers, and atmospheric rivers are going to become able to carry a lot more moisture in the future. So when they do make landfall, they are, you know, just because of the warming of the atmosphere and the ability of warmer air to hold more moisture, that means that when these things hit, then they will pack a lot more of a punch in the future.
I was surprised to learn that the flood doesn't have to follow the fire just a few months later. It can be longer than that. How long is that delay factor where floods might, hurt an area even though the fire was sometime previous?
Yeah, I think that's an important question, and I think it probably depends on where you are and what kind of impact you're worried about, right? So if you're particularly concerned about debris flows or landslides specifically, then that, like, the largest risk there is within the first year after a wildfire, because then, like, after that, like, the kind of chaparral-style vegetation that we get in Southern California, for example, has had time to regrow and, like, reestablish some of, like, the root zones, and so, like, the risk of rapid erosion isn't as large, although it still is elevated relative to what it was for a few years. But yeah, even in that situation where you're not worried specifically about like a debris flow, still the risk of larger than normal runoff can be a lot bigger even like several years after a wildfire as well.
It kind of sounds like California might as well get ready for more and more of these compound strikes. Is that what you find, and how often might they come?
So yeah, it's exactly what we find. Don't really take much joy in reporting this, but it does look like this rapid succession fire weather rainfall type of sequence is going to become fairly frequent in the future. It looks like the risk of that in the majority of the western U.S. will at least double by the end of the 21st century.
Do you think this study tells us something about places outside the western U.S., like the Mediterranean or Australia?
It might. We haven't studied the variability of these extreme fire weather rainfall sequences in any other region yet. But, yeah, I would imagine that the drivers of these things are pretty robust in a lot of places, right? Like, we know it's getting warmer. We know globally the changes in extreme precipitation are also really reliable. So most likely, if we were to replicate this study in other Mediterranean climate regions, I would expect to see something similar. But, yeah, we would need to actually go through the exercise to be sure.
Samantha Stevenson, do you think there could be multiple extreme events in one year, like more than a 1-2 punch, but a series of blows? Is that possible?
It is possible, yeah, because these things are essentially like rolls of the dice. Right? We're not claiming that it's like extreme fire weather is causing rainfall, but extreme rainfall, but it just is going to happen by chance sometimes. So yes, it is definitely possible that as these extreme rainfall events themselves become more frequent, just statistically, you're going to get more years in which multiple rainfall events could follow a particular fire. And in fact, that is one thing that we've quantified in the study.
Science is getting a clearer and clearer picture of a new climate on this planet. Samantha, what are you working on next?
That's a great question. I'm working on a few things, and they're all kind of under the umbrella of understanding how climate variability will respond to climate change. So we're really interested in, say, like how El Niño events, so changes in variability in tropical Pacific Ocean temperatures will respond to climate change, and how that might drive some of these changes in atmospheric circulation that are associated with these atmospheric river events, such as these wildfires. We're also interested in the impact in the ocean, too. Like we've got a whole theme of research that's going on trying to look at, say, how do heat waves in the ocean work and how do those respond to climate change. And it's another situation where if our idea of normal is continuously changing and you have superimposed on that just some amount of variability. So there's going to be shocks to many ecosystems and to human societies that we expect to intensify in the future.
Yeah, oceans cover most of the planet. I wonder if there will be sort of mega droughts and mega pluvials over the seas.
For a lot of like the marine applications, they're worrying more about like temperature and changes in ocean pH and the types of nutrients that are available in the ocean. But yeah, like I think there's a whole fascinating realm of compound extremes to be looked at in the ocean as well.
As we speak, listeners are struggling with a pandemic, war, and economic stress. How can we keep attention on the climate crisis with so much else going on? And personally, how do you keep going?
Yeah, I think that's another great question. And it's just, you know, I guess we should all just kind of take a deep breath and recognize that we are dealing with a lot right now. And So getting by in a world where we have to deal with so many both climate-driven and just societal challenges is kind of a big deal right now. I think that what keeps me going is just the idea that even though there is so much bad stuff going on in the world, like that it might be possible to try to use improved scientific knowledge to help us adapt to some of those things. And so I'm always trying to keep my eye on that and to try to say, okay, well, we're locked into a future where a lot of these impacts are getting worse, but at least we can try to be better prepared and to try to know that, like, life goes on, right? Like, humans are really resilient and we are impressive in that sense. So just trying to stay positive as much as possible.
From the University of California, we've been speaking with Dr. Samantha Stevenson, and you can find links to these scientific papers in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Samantha, thank you for sharing your work with us.
Great, yeah, thanks so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In war, humans count the war dead, buildings and roads destroyed. But we are not alone on this planet. Plants and animals are also casualties of war. So is the atmosphere. We don't hear about that, except from a few voices like author and journalist Nicholas Kozlov. Nicholas spent years not just studying South America, but living there. With his doctorate in Latin American history from Oxford, we could call him Dr. Kozlov. He published on Hugo Chavez and oil politics in Latin America and the book Revolution, South America, and the Rise of the New Left. It's a story which continues with recent leftist wins in countries like Chile. But in 2014, Kozlov turned towards the Ukraine and the ancient environment of the Black and Azov Seas. He traveled there four times in recent years and just published a blog roundup called Climate Emergency and War. From New York City, Nicholas Kozlov, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, we last spoke on the program in 2010 about the South American perspective. It was about the Cancun climate talks, actually. Seems like a long time ago. And I knew you as an expert on South America, from the deep Amazon jungle to oil politics. Tell us how you turned towards the ecoregion around the Ukraine and revolutionary hopes there.
Well, I'm a very idealistic person. So when the Maidan Revolution took place in Ukraine in 2014, I was very focused on it. And then I made 4 trips to Ukraine in subsequent years, reporting on any number of issues, including the environment.
Talk to us about your 2016 book, Ukraine's Revolutionary Ghosts. How does that look now?
Well, I went to Ukraine. I went to Kyiv. I interviewed many of the original youthful participants of the Maidan Revolution who were very concerned about that the Maidan Revolution would be squandered and that their social agenda would be ignored. And so it was a very idealistic take on the original youthful Maidan Revolution. And I also addressed such issues as ethnic minorities, anti-Semitism, the fight against oligarchical rule and whatnot. But as you mentioned, some of these issues in the context of the current conflict look a little bit quaint, I would have to say.
Well, people in Europe and especially in America immediately want to believe Ukraine wants to be just like us. They want to join the pool of super capitalist banks and get all the Western military weapons. Is that what Ukraine wanted in 2014? And is it what Ukrainians want now? What do you think?
Well, I've been in slight contact with some of my original contacts. Obviously, it's been a little more limited because people are just dealing with day-to-day survival. But my sense going back a few years was that there was a bit of ambivalence about NATO. But I think that perhaps now, in the context of war, perhaps those pro-Western sentiments may be strengthened, perhaps even on the amongst the original participants of the Maidan Revolution, the progressive left, etc.
Well, let's get away from the merely human. Talk to us about the environmental treasures at risk around the Ukraine region. Maybe we could start with that branch of the ocean that so few people in the West know about, the Sea of Azov.
Well, I was concerned about this environmental situation going back as far as 2014, and I wrote an article at that time in the aftermath of Putin's annexation of Crimea, which had obviously political consequences, but also economic consequences because there's just a tremendous amount of offshore oil and gas development in the Black and Azov Seas. And so I'm sure that Putin was motivated by diplomatic and political concerns in annexing Crimea, but in the process, there were some economic benefits because Russia absorbed a lot of that offshore oil development, but to the detriment of the environment and local wildlife.
Right, so there's a whole Russian fleet out in the Black Sea right now, so I presume that they control the oil and gas fields there. Are there actually developments there? Are the drilling platforms up in the seas, or is it a future thing?
Yeah, there is offshore oil and gas. And my concern is that not bringing this issue up to the present, there's been fighting in the Black Sea Biosphere Reserve, which is a UNESCO protected area. And the fighting, the explosions can be viewed from space. So I'm actually very concerned about this. And so in hindsight, I think my article from 2014 and my concerns on this front, unfortunately, they look a little bit prophetic. And I'm a little concerned about marine wildlife, for example, the Black Sea dolphin and sturgeon, which has been on the verge of extinction. And even before this conflict emerged, you had a lot of oil and gas contamination. And going back as far as 2007, I believe, there was an oil tanker which just broke apart in some freak storm in the Kerch Strait, which connects the Sea of Azov to the Black Sea. And a lot of local bird and wildlife was damaged by that spill. So this is actually an issue which predates this military conflict, but I think it could be exacerbated by the war.
Yeah, I could see a whole environmental movement to save the Black Sea. And both of those seas had decent fisheries for a very long time, but I've heard that that's on the edge and maybe overfished or polluted out of existence. And then you have all the wild birds that use the marshes along those seas. They're in danger. It sounds like a whole part of nature could be endangered by our human craziness, really.
Yeah, and you have such species as whale. It's a species of bird which was recklessly endangered by this spill that I mentioned going back as far as 2007. And so they were damaged by this oil spill, and they were on the beach and attacked by wild dogs. And so that was a key case of local wildlife being jeopardized by the oil industry in the area. And you're right. I think prior to oil development, reportedly, the local inhabitants in the Sea of Azov would go fishing. You have these Cossack communities, and the quality of the water was adequate, if not high quality. And that's been obviously jeopardized by the oil industry.
Well, let's get to the land of the Ukraine. When missiles ignite big oil and chemical tanks, the TV cameras lap it up. It's exciting video, and it's a sign of somebody winning and somebody losing, they claim. But, you know, for climate-aware people, those gas and oil strikes are a double disaster. We see even more carbon dioxide heading into the atmosphere to bring the storms and fires and weather extremes. Nicholas, what are your thoughts about the climate impacts of yet another war?
Well, I think if anything, this conflict has demonstrated that many of our forms of energy are quite antiquated, and that's certainly obvious when you have the Russians shelling an oil reservoir or a gas pipeline, or you have elevated levels of radioactivity emanating from Chernobyl or the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. And so I think the conflict has highlighted these concerns about our antiquated forms of energy use. I wrote the article because I'm quite an idealistic person, so even though this is a horrific conflict, I would like to find the silver lining. And if it takes a crisis for Europe and the wider world to move towards renewables, then I don't want to say that that's desirable, but under the circumstances, maybe there is some silver lining in this crisis.
Yeah, a bit of a bright side. You know, one other thing before we leave energy in the land is the coal mining. Something I didn't really think about until I read your article is Ukraine has been long known for massive coal mining, and now the soldiers are digging trenches and missiles are blowing craters up all around that. When the mining stops, perhaps because of the war, is coal passive or is it toxic?
I'm not entirely sure of that, but I do have some concerns about Europe reviving coal production, because this is going to be a huge issue. Because if Europe ceases to purchase Russian gas, then what are you replacing that with? And there's been talk about Poland, for example, turning towards coal. So I think probably in the best case scenario, this war will hasten Europe's and perhaps the rest of the world's turn towards renewables. But in the process of trying to replace Russian gas, what are you replacing it with? Are you replacing it with coal? Are you replacing it with liquid natural gas, which has a higher carbon footprint than regular gas or nuclear? So I have these concerns that even as many European countries talk about transitioning towards green energy, in order to make up the shortfall from Russian gas, they might have to turn towards other forms of energy use, which could cancel out that turn towards renewable energy.
You know, the Ukraine's leading climate scientist, Svetlana Krakowska, was working to finalize a report for the IPCC when bombs started falling around her. And she immediately said, this is a fossil fuel war. How would you interpret that, Nicholas?
Yeah, I would definitely say that, since Russia finances its weapons through the sale of oil, gas, and fossil fuels. So I absolutely agree with that connection that she's making.
Yeah, but, you know, so is the American military. The biggest single institutional polluter of the atmosphere is the U.S. military. So when you see all the planes heading over to Europe with arms and troops screwing around doing exercises, whether they're at war or not, it all adds to fossil fuels, and it really doesn't benefit anybody as far as I can see.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. It's also true that the United States has put a sanctioned Russian gas, but then in the process, Biden is tapping the nation's strategic oil reserve. And so this seems to be answering more towards maybe keeping gas prices low, protecting the Democrats in advance of the midterm elections, because consumers are angry about the high price of gas at the pump. But it really is quite a contrast to Biden's pledges in the 2020 election on climate change. And so you get these very strange contorted reactions to this crisis. On the one hand, in the best of all possible worlds, I suppose it could hasten the turn towards renewable energy. But in the short term, I also see some counterproductive moves as well.
Yeah, the American energy lobby is flooding U.S. TV with advertising reminding everyone it's patriotic to push for more fossil fuel production to save the free world. And meanwhile, U.N. General Secretary Antonio Guterres just said fossil fuels are weapons of mass destruction. So contortion is the right word that you just used. How do you see this reframing of oil and gas in a time of war?
I think, again, in the best of all possible worlds, you know, you hear about Germany, for example, which is was reluctant to break with Russian gas imports, and they're going to turn off the they're going to cease the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which I agree with. But I guess the question is, will it be enough? And I don't minimize the practical challenges of transitioning towards this new green energy. And so I guess the question is, will solar and wind be enough with the Paris Climate Accord basically on life support? And so Bill McKibben, for example, has talked about this massive investment in heat pumps, electrical heat pumps, which transfer energy as opposed to supplying it. So what he's calling for is this massive ramping up of electrical heat pumps. Whether that's going to be enough to make up for this shortfall in the gas supply from Russia, I don't really know. But I guess my attitude at this point is whatever it takes to wake people up to this climate emergency, and so however horrific this conflict might be, perhaps this is just the necessary push that people need, because I was very discouraged during COVID. I thought that was another opportunity to address the climate emergency, and emissions plunged in 2020, and then they shot up in 2021. So I thought that was a missed opportunity. So maybe if anything, there might be a slight silver lining this time.
You published a revolutionary handbook about how to bring about nonviolent revolutionary change. If we defund fossil fuels and we go with localized renewable resources, that seems revolutionary to the people currently making a lot of money and in charge. Do you think big government knows that and they fear that transition?
Well, I'm not entirely convinced of that in the United States. I think if you judge them by their words, officials in the EU seem a little more on top of just how dire the situation is and how much the Paris Climate Accord is really on life support at this point. And they seem to also recognize that there are these contradictions. In other words, if you turn towards LNG or liquid natural gas, then if that has a higher carbon footprint than regular gas, then that could negate all these other renewables. And so I think the real question is, pragmatically, how do you move towards net zero? And so maybe it's just going to be it has to be a climate mobilization at the scale of the Marshall Plan. And so I don't know if there's a political will to do that, but again, I'm an idealistic person, so hopefully there will be a slight silver lining in this conflict, and so we can start to get the ball rolling, which was not taken advantage of during the COVID emergency. And I think what's also discouraging is that COVID demonstrated that people can change their personal behavior. And so I think that COVID demonstrated that in a pandemic, people are capable of doing that. And so I would like to see the same commitment when it comes to climate. And I don't really see that right now in the United States, but perhaps in Europe, things seem to be moving in the right direction.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
We are talking with Nicholas Kozloff from New York City. What do you think? Is nuclear power the answer to climate change? The U.S. has announced they're going to do more nuclear building. Even France said they were going to get out of it, and now they're back with, I think they're going to build 12 more reactors, they say. Well, what's your view on this?
Well, certainly from the climate perspective, nuclear power is much more desirable than other forms of fossil fuel extraction. But obviously, nuclear power comes with a host of other problems. And then, needless to say, as we've seen in this military conflict in Ukraine, there have been elevated levels of radiation from the Chernobyl plants, which in turn experienced a dire accident in 1986. And the fallout from that is still apparent in Ukraine as well as Belarus. And so I think maybe the military conflict in Ukraine has highlighted concerns over nuclear power, because in the best of circumstances, nuclear power plants should run safely. But in the middle of a military conflict, all bets are off, obviously. So I have quite a few concerns about nuclear power, although I can see in some ways it might be in some ways attractive because it has lower emissions, but I don't think that's ultimately the solution we should be looking for.
Well, for me, I think nuclear technology has always been and always will be deeply entwined with nuclear weapons making, and nuclear weapons had been the major possibility of human extinction up until the climate crisis arrived. So for me, I am definitely against that as a solution. But you've been writing about social change. We are again seeing another hope of that in South America. Do you think there's any hope of avoiding a future of continuing climate disasters without a revolution in human social organization in every country, including America and Europe?
Oh, gosh. It's a huge question. I would say, just getting back to COVID, I was encouraged just to move this from maybe an abstract to a personal level. I was pretty encouraged in the beginning of, I don't want to say encouraged because the pandemic was obviously horrific, but, I live here in Brooklyn and you saw far fewer motorists on the streets, and it seemed like we had a bit of a respite from the climate emergency. And then it just seemed like then everyone just got back on the roads. We've had just unbelievable amounts of traffic in the neighborhood, and the cops are just not really enforcing the law, and you have motorists thumbing their nose at pedestrians, and it didn't really seem to me like we took advantage of that moment to bring greater awareness to climate change issues. So I just getting back to what I was saying before, however horrific this crisis might be, maybe we won't miss the next opportunity to address climate change through this Russian gas because of concerns over Russian gas. Perhaps we will take advantage of this situation and not kick the can down the road as we did during COVID.
Desmond Tutu said, "I'm not an optimist, I'm a prisoner of hope." And that seems to be what I'm hearing from you. I mean, there are times when I feel like I should just give up. The Amazon rainforest seems as doomed as the Greenland glaciers. I feel like maybe I should just quit and spend my remaining days on the best beach I can find. How are you holding up?
Well, throughout the pandemic, I was writing about, because I just, not to sound pedantic about this, but I am a very idealistic person. So throughout the pandemic, I was writing about, okay, well, how can we find the silver linings in this situation to address climate change? And for example, you had all these concerns about the meat industry and health and safety. And during COVID, because workers were falling ill. And so I wrote a number of articles essentially arguing that, well, however horrific the situation might be, again, perhaps this might be an opportunity to address supply chain issues and health and nutrition and start moving away from meat-based diet, which is also affecting the planet. And so I think perhaps there was a greater awareness around health and safety during the pandemic, and so that's another area that I was hoping that we could take advantage of that to reorganize supply chains, because agriculture and the food supply chain also accounts for a great degree of our climate change problems, and I'm not sure that's going to happen, but. You do have, for example, these vertical farms. You have a great movement in the cities towards self-sufficiency. And here in New York, you have Mayor Eric Adams. I'm not saying that I agree with Eric Adams on every political issue, but he's been pushing this issue of food justice, food self-sufficiency, vertical farms. So perhaps there were some glimmerings or movement towards addressing climate change through food justice during the pandemic. And so maybe that's what people need. They need a bit of a push because normally, unless there's a crisis, unfortunately, people are slow to respond.
As we wrap up here, what are you working on these days? Do you have a new book in mind, or do you have a subject that you're following intensely?
Well, it's interesting you should mention that. I have any number of articles planned about Ukraine, but I was also planning to go back to South America to retrace Darwin's voyage, which, as you know, proved instrumental in the development of the theory of evolution. And so Darwin, observing wildlife in such places as the Galapagos, developed key ideas on evolution. But because of climate change, animals are having to adapt on a much heightened time scale. So I was hoping to make my way back to South America and to retrace Darwin's voyage, but this time to see how wildlife is adapting on this accelerated time scale to climate change.
From New York City, we've been speaking with widely published author and journalist Nicholas Kozloff, and you can find more of his work at nicholaskozloff.com and find links for this interview at ecoshock.org. Nicholas, thank you for sharing your time with us.
All right. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I think we get a new insight from Nicholas Kozloff here. Over the past two or three years, climate activism has been stalled by the pandemic, and now public attention is on the Ukraine, not to mention inflated prices at home. We are all stunned by these developments, and it was natural to think, well, we have to wait until this clears up before we can get momentum going again in the climate campaign. But now we know a decade of multiple disruptions loom ahead of us, and this is the last decade we have to determine what will happen to the world's climate after 2050. Scientists on this program explain the next years of extreme climate events are already cooked in. They are determined by our past emissions. Cutting back and going green can't change that right now. Our actions now, though, can help future decades, including the times of our children and grandchildren, in a very big way. We can steer away from a catastrophic future by our actions now. As Kozloff said, we need to retain the work from home, didn't drive around, cut consumption of useless junk developed during the pandemic. We needed to use that emergency to reduce our emissions, and we did. But sadly, most Western-style consumers want to go back. They want to make up for lost time with even more international tourist flights, burning carbon, and buying even more stuff. It is that rush of demand after production was cut during the pandemic that is partly causing current steep rises in prices. Now the conflict in Ukraine has demonstrated how Europe depends on Russian fossil fuels for everything, for heat, for manufacturing. There is a lot of talk about ramping up renewables to fill that gap, and we must hope that happens. This is another example of working with the crisis to develop a more sustainable economy. The old normal is not coming back. There isn't going to be a peaceful break without weather extremes and human social twists. A time when we can hang banners and celebrate in climate camps like the old days. There isn't going to be the slow process of social process to get ponderous legislative change years later. We need a new climate action that is ready to use every stress point to reduce greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere. It's that simple. And to save all the natural systems while they are still functioning. Through warm stores and tears, smart and dedicated minds all over the world need to coordinate the new climate action. Nicholas also pointed to a new call from Bill McKibben of 350.org, help solve the energy crisis with heat pumps. I lived for 2 years in a house in Canada that was heated and cooled by a heat pump. They have some limitations, but they definitely work, and they can save the homeowner money while reducing climate emissions. A heat pump is basically a fan with refrigeration-type coils and a compressor. The noisy part usually sits outside the building. When your space is too hot, the heat pump collects that heat inside and shoves it out. When you need heat, the pump collects heat from the outside air and brings that in. Now, it seems unlikely you will get heat from air that's already below the freezing point, but good heat pumps can do that. It works well down to about minus 30 Fahrenheit or minus 34 degrees C. Few places get colder than that, but if you are in the far north or way up in the mountains, you might need backup heat of some kind for those rare occasions. We ran our heat pump during heat waves up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 48 degrees C, and it worked, although our inside temperature struggled to stay in the high 70s or about 26 degrees C inside for a few hours in the far big parts of the sunny day. That is still quite habitable, though. Trying to power an air conditioner with solar power can be difficult unless you have a big array on your home, but it is much easier to power a heat pump for air conditioning with fewer solar panels. You are most likely to need AC when the sun is shining, so it all works well. Getting enough solar power for a heat pump in winter seems less likely unless you live in the southern desert. If electricity in your area comes from burning fossil fuels, especially coal, you can cut emissions for heating and cooling by, well, possibly 50%, even 70% in our experience. That is a huge gain for the climate. The heat pump runs on electricity. We compared our heating bills with the heat pump to others in the neighborhood who used electric heats like baseboards and those with comparable insulation. Our bills were about a quarter of the electric heated homes. That's a huge saving. Our bills with the heat pump were still less over the season compared to people heating with natural gas, and that was when natural gas was at giveaway prices at the time. Of course, real renewables plus heat pumps is the best way to go. But if your electricity is produced from an old coal plant, you may have to measure the plus and minus of emissions carefully. The prices of heat pumps have come down substantially and could go even further with mass production. But keep in mind, the current generation of heat pumps only work for about 10 to 12 years, and then you need to replace them. So you need to include that purchase cost in your calculations. On a new build, installing a heat pump is usually way less expensive than installing a furnace. A heat pump can be added to any space, even old houses, using a technology called a ductless mini-split. A ductless mini-split. The noisy compressor pump goes outdoors. The cooling and heat distribution unit goes inside on a wall. It does not require hooking up to any existing furnace vents. Lots of people in our village have purchased those mini splits, costing about $1,000 on sale at the time, and it totally works for them. McKibben is right. We need to change minds and change the world with millions of heat pumps. Bill McKibben has called on President Biden to use the Defense Production Act to get American manufacturers to start producing electric heat pumps in quantity so we can ship them to Europe, he says. Those heat pumps will be especially climate-friendly in parts of Europe where a lot of electricity comes from wind farms and solar. this could be an example of using an energy crisis to advance the cause of a safe future climate, as Kozloff suggested. It is time to bring back an old word from the 1960s, brinksmanship. Brinksmanship is the practice of trying to achieve an advantageous outcome by pushing dangerous events to the brink of an active conflict. That's what Wiki says. The tactic occurs in international politics, foreign policy, labor relations, contemporary military strategy, by involving the threat of nuclear weapons, for example. The maneuver of pushing a situation with the opponent to the brink succeeds by forcing the opponent to back down and makes concessions. That might be achieved through diplomatic maneuvers, by creating the impression that one is willing to use extreme methods rather than concede. Continuing from Wikipedia, the term is chiefly associated with U.S. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles from 1953 to 1956 during the Eisenhower administration. Dulles sought to deter aggression by the Soviet Union by warning that the cost might be massive retaliation against Soviet targets. That ends from Wiki. I would add the October 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, too. At that time, both sides sailed up to the edge of nuclear war. And that is where we are again, aren't we, kiddies? Sending little missiles, not big ones, drones, not fighter jets, holding back chemical and nuclear weapons for now, as well as total cyber war, which is surprising. Tiptoeing through a minefield of mass annihilation. Careful now. How contagious is this variant of the military virus that periodically attacks humankind? Wiki says, Thomas Schelling defined brinksmanship as manipulating the shared risk of war. The essence of such a crisis is that it leaves neither side to be in full control of events and creates a serious risk of miscalculation and escalation. The pioneering game theorist Thomas Schelling called that the threat that leaves something to chance. I don't like the sounds of that, but that's where we are, brinksmanship, and it's true not only for war, but also for our energy situation and for climate change, really. We're going to the brink. Procrastination. Let's go to Wikipedia again. Procrastination is the action of unnecessarily and voluntarily delaying or postponing something, despite knowing there will be negative consequences for doing so. We need this word procrastination to describe government policy failures and frightening gaps in the public movement towards climate action. The public just doesn't seem to get it, and when they do, they want to deal with it in 2030 or 2040. We can't right now. You see, there's other crises to deal with. We've got our own problems. We are all procrastinators now. Procrastination is killing millions of future lives. Billions if you count animals, plants, and insects that will be driven to extinction by climate change. Given the present and the bounty of scientific research, the future is pretty well known. Facts and patterns can be seen from space right down to the world's most powerful electron microscope that can watch atoms. We have a few beginning clues of what to do with technology, but we have no real vision how to reorganize socially to live without making greenhouse gases. Humans lived without fossil fuels for most of our 100,000 years. It can be done. We have done it. Historically, that is the normal way to live without fossil fuels. Maybe the climate crisis can begin to thaw relations as science did in the Cold War. Maybe someday, in the fires, heat, weird cold snaps and hurricanes, humans will agree to set aside other differences and work together as a species on a small planet. That's the small hope we have. My thanks to all the listeners who support this show. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Joanna Macy, A Wiser, Braver World. On the summer solstice of 2020, Joanna Macy, from her home in Berkeley, spoke at the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The Buddhist monastery had called for awakened action and invited women leaders to speak to race, poverty, climate, and the COVID pandemic. Joanna Macy is an eco-philosopher and a scholar of Buddhism and deep ecology. Now in her very early 90s, she has for decades helped transform despair and apathy into constructive change. As teacher, writer of 8 books, and anti-nuclear activist, she has created frameworks for personal and social change. Joanna Macy is probably best known as the founder and root teacher of the work that reconnects. Thanks to Roshi Joan Halifax and the Upaya Zen Center, and to Joanna Macy for their permission to broadcast this inspiring talk.
Delighted to be here. What a marvelous idea came to you, Roshi Joan. And I am so grateful to be included in the voices that you are bringing to so many. So I'd like to say that for the last 40 years, I've been growing a form of experiential group work. It's called the work that reconnects. Actually, one way of describing it is that it helps people tell the truth about what they experience is happening to their world. And it helps them find the motivations and tools and resources for taking part in the healing of their world. Now, at the outset, when we're getting underway, we help each other discern certain features of the present situation, which include 3 stories or versions of reality that are progressively shaping our world so that they can see them more clearly and choose which one they want to get behind. Now, these 3 are business as usual, the great unraveling, and the great turning, as we put it. So business as usual, by that we mean you got to grow the economy. That means global corporate capitalism. Now, we also call that the industrial growth society, because its key feature is the necessity to keep growing the economy, which of course commodifies our earth. And also we include that for those nations that don't like the word, use the word capitalist, though they come to resemble it in their need to compete. So many voices tell us the story of the necessity for economic growth. Politicians running for government posts, corporations, and the military, and the corporate-controlled media. Now, the next is the great unraveling, and I love that term because not only does it refer to the unraveling of ecological, biological, social systems as we are commodifying them. But I like the term because systems, all of these don't just fall over dead, but they just gradually, as they're under assault, being mined and extracted and commodified, they lose their coherence, their integrity, their memory, how to keep on going. So that's the second feature of the state we're in. And the third story of our era is the transition to a life-sustaining culture. Now, I want you to know, and we emphasize this and demonstrate it, that this transition to a life-sustaining culture is a revolution in the magnitude and scope comparable to the agricultural revolutions 1,000 years ago or the industrial revolution a few centuries back. There are many ways to refer to it, but we've taken in the work that we connect to calling it the Great Turning. So seeing this trio, or put it simply, our work is to help us survive the first two stories and bring more and more people and resources into this third story, this great transition, this turning. Over the last couple of years, a number of us recognized that given the pace of the great unraveling and the destruction being wrought by the Industrial Growth Society, we are heading toward economic and indeed social collapse. Our thinking and courage in thinking about collapse has been helped by the deep adaptation work of Jem Bendel and Deep Adaptation Forum, to say nothing of earlier work and studies by Pablo Servigne of France and Belgium and his company, whose books are only just now coming out in English. And since we're finding courage to look at the possibility of collapse or even the likelihood of it, and since our world economy has proven incapable so far of cutting greenhouse gas emissions at all, it is now obvious that we cannot avoid a climate catastrophe. We have been assuming that the great turning to a life-sustaining society might be able to come first or to forestall such a collapse. But now we've come to see it, that the great turning is more like a vision and a commitment within us that can help us survive the collapse of the Industrial Growth Society and keep on going. And the motivation and the skills that we gain in the work that reconnects will serve us here in providing perseverance, inspiration, trust. In that case, in a way, I think the great turning becomes something more internal, like a certain, almost like bodhicitta, which is the bodhisattva's determination to serve the welfare of all beings, like a flame in the heart. So now, with the likelihood, or indeed possibility, but I'll say likelihood of economic collapse and climate catastrophe looming, we can sense that we are in a space without a map, that we're on shifting ground, where old habits and old scenarios, all previous expectations, all familiar features no longer apply. It's like we're unmoored, cast loose. In Tibetan Buddhism, such a place or gap between known worlds is called a bardo. It's kind of frightening. It's also a place of potential transformation. As you enter the bardo, they're facing you is the Buddha Akshobhya. His element is water. He is holding a mirror, for his gift is mirror wisdom, reflecting everything just as it is. And the teaching of Akshobhya's mirror is this: Do not look away. Do not avert your gaze. Do not turn aside. This teaching clearly calls for radical attention and total acceptance. Well, for us right now, it's pretty clear who's holding up Akshobhya's mirror. COVID-19. It's come on us fast. We knew nothing of it just a short while ago. But right away, it made us stop. It made us stop to take in what the mirror reflects. It made us stop. We've been so busy and distracted in our different versions of the rat race that we couldn't pay attention to our actual situation. We have to stop our rushing in order to see who and what we are. This teaching of COVID-19 reminds us again that apocalypse, in its ancient meaning, connotes revelation and unveiling. Look at what, it's easy to see what it has revealed and unveiled. Right away, the first days, it revealed our failed healthcare system. At the same time, it revealed our utter interdependence when facing a pandemic so contagious. Right away, without anybody preaching from a pulpit, we could realize that we can't be healthy unless all are healthy. Our need to prioritize our collective well-being rose right up to the surface. Remember that? Especially within our country, which is one of the most hyper-individualized countries in the world. Patterns of contagion showed us pretty soon what we most need to see. The nursing homes, where the aging are warehoused. The meatpacking industry, so dangerous to the crowded workers, so cruel to the animals, so costly to the climate. And right away, as soon right after the heels of that, the prisons. They rose into our view, prisons where millions are locked away, now becoming petri dishes of contamination. And COVID-19, holding up its mirror wisdom, laid bare the fault lines of racial inequality in our society and the disproportionate impacts on Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. Remember when we heard 60% of the cases are African American? Thanks to pre-existing conditions due to inequities in health care and environmental racism. And on top of that, just 4 weeks ago, can you believe it? Just 4 weeks, the killing of George Floyd has not only revealed the racism and brutality of our police culture, but inflamed unparalleled protests sweeping the country and going so far as to call for the defunding and indeed the abolition of police departments and police unions. Here, in what I say again is the most hyper-individualized country in the world, many of us are discovering and seeing that others discover a new solidarity in our utter determination to move beyond the sick racism we've inherited and sustained. And in this uprising, we're inspired by the courage, creativity, and perseverance of the demonstrators, bringing along with them so many civil servants, members of city councils and police departments. A New York City council member I heard yesterday speaking on the passage of the council of police reforms, dramatic changes within the police department that he acknowledged they had been working on since Eric Garner's asphyxiation by the police. "I can't breathe," he cried, as did George Floyd. "It's no time for my giving excuses, because it is clear now that this is a time of reckoning." Reckoning. So it's no wonder that the Bardo was seen as a place where the unknown, even the inconceivable, can happen, and where you can be changed forever. Now, having looked at that, I want to take a moment, the rest of my time, to look at, because in the coming years, we're going to all be facing great hardship and chaotic conditions. And so we're willing, I sense from this day together and my work, that we're ready for that. But here are some things that can help. And let me offer them to you in describing some aspects of the work that we commit. So let me start with what is definitive for many of us. And first, let me just say, I don't have a number of the people doing the work that reconnects. We're not an organization even. It just spreads. We have a network. We have some books. We have contagious practices. But we have spread to every country in the Northern Hemisphere and down, and many in the Southern Hemisphere too, in the Global South rather. And in each one, it is affirming, interestingly enough, people's own indigenous native traditions as they find impetus and understanding for moving toward a life-sustaining civilization in spite of the destruction made by the global corporate capitalism, the industrial growth society. Anyway, the spiral of the work is definitive of it, and it's like a circle, but it repeats itself. And to keep on going, so you can, but each turn of the spiral, which can happen in a workshop or many times in your life, it becomes something that helps sustain you and move you forward. There are four stations in that spiral. And there's gratitude, and then there's honoring our pain for the world, then there's seeing with new eyes and going forth. So we have found it in hard times that there's nothing like gratitude for starting with. It grounds you. It's not surprising that every single religion and spiritual path that we know of seems to have started with praise and gratitude. And what it does for us in this Bardo-like time is it grounds us, and we feel our feet on the soil. We feel that we're part of a living planet, and it's our good fortune to be here with her, the living earth, at this moment of such great trial and tribulation and possibility as well, and huge, humongous change. And in gratitude, you already are peeled away from things that addict you to the consumer culture, because you know what keeps you going. and you don't need the things that are marketed to make you feel good. You know what you have. You are here. You are with the Great Mother. You are with each other. Where else would you want to be? So gratitude grounds you so that you can then move into the next station, which is honoring our pain for the world. Not pathologizing it, which is a temptation for us, which makes it very rewarding. The grief and outrage we feel can be so rewarding for the big pharma and their billion-dollar earnings. No, it's not to pathologize, but to embrace, to honor and respect. Now, we've talked quite a bit, I've heard today, about grief. This is more than that. Grief, yes, of course. And fear, the dread. Grief, yes, and the anger, the outrage. Oh, that's good to be able to express. Grief, yes, and the insufficiency and powerlessness. Who, me? What can I do? And in the truth mandala, that is a feature of our work that has spread very widely on its own, sometimes just on its own, we have symbols for these four within the mandala. And we also bring forward, as we invite people to come in and express and contend with them, their tantric sides. For grief, the tantric or source side is love. We only grieve what we love. To meet your fear, you need such courage. Its tantric side is bravery and courage, etc. Oh, for outrage and anger, you might be wondering, what's the source or tantric side of that? It's passion for justice. So each of these, an insufficiency or powerlessness, that one, oh me, I'm not up to it, I'm just a little, is that sense of lack is turned into the newness, is something side, the emptiness from which the new can arise. So I have benefited so greatly from this work. So I'm grateful to call it to your attention as we go forward into times that are waiting for us, that are chaotic and trying. And after that, what we come into, because we find then that as we encounter the grief and rage and fear, that this is actually causing us to reach out more and to actually experience our larger identity in every one of those, if you are paying attention. Every one of them widens our sense in widening circles. And we, in the work, use these widening circles to extend our relevance and our unique importance right now at this point through space and time. And so we do a lot of role playing at this part of the spiral. We experience and play with our solidarity with more than human beings. Maybe some of you have already taken part in a council of all beings, where you move beyond your soul identification with your human identity, instead of stepping out of shoes that are too tight, and allow more than human beings to speak through you. Or in your identity in the presence of past and future generations, because this moment with our living earth is culminating time for the past, the ancestors. Every ancestor is here with us now in what we're facing. Don't doubt it. Use it. Open to it. And the future generations as well. One of my teachers, nuclear scientist, Gray Nun, Rosalie Bertel, said, every being who will ever live is here now. Where? Ah, in our ovaries, in our gonads, in our DNA. They are here with us now. What a beautiful, beautiful calling we have to be able to play with them, giving them a chance to live. I think my time is up, so I close with gratitude and being able to share this moment with you, my dear fellow journeyers. We're so lucky in a way to be alive right now. Would you want to miss it? We're so lucky in a way to have each other. Mm. And teachings of the ancestors and the company of the future.
That was Joanna Macy, eco-philosopher and scholar of Buddhism. She spoke from her home in Berkeley, California, at the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at their Awakened Action Symposium. Joanna Macy had been asked to recommend resources from her writings. Here they are. Her 2011 book, which happens to be my personal favorite. It's entitled Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. And written 3 years later with Molly Brown, Coming Back to Life, the updated guide to the work that reconnects. And lastly, a very recent book from April 2020, A Wild Love for the World, Joanna Macy and the Work of Our Time. It's an anthology edited by Stephanie Kaza. A video of this talk by Joanna Macy, A Wiser, Braver World, is archived by the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Visit Joanna Macy's website at joannamacy.net. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.